Hi, everybody. This is Dr. Bruce Pierce with the next episode of my podcast, Women's Healthcare with Dr. Bruce Pierce. And today, my special guest, I'm quite excited, is Dr. Bert Mandelbaum, who is the chairman of pediatrics or chair of pediatrics at Princeton Health, Penn Medicine, Princeton Health. Welcome, Dr. Mandelbaum.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Would you prefer me to call you Dr. Mandelbaum what's your preference?
So as a pediatrician, we're relatively informal. I'm totally fine with Bert. If you want,
I could tell by your baseball cap and your T-shirt that it's very laid back.
So May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and part of mental health is exercising. So clinically, I'm off today. So I went for a run and exercised a little bit. So I appreciate the podcast format.
Oh, great. Well, I could certainly work on my mental health. I have plenty of room there. So our topic today. I know it's women's healthcare, but I'm sure you're well aware. Pediatrics, I guess, is part of women's healthcare. Most of the patients come with their moms. Is that correct? Or, you know, I know moms and dads, but mostly moms.
Yeah, well, to be politically correct, it could be either parent who comes with them or another guardian. But yes, in general, it still is the moms who bring them in. And yeah, we are clearly related. You guys hand off the babies to us and then we take it and run.
We are teammates.
Right.
Tag team. All right.
We can't do it without each other.
Perfect. So today's episode is actually a hot topic, slightly controversial, although, of course, we think maybe it shouldn't be, but it is. We have to deal with it. It's about vaccines, whether to vaccinate or not, or to have some alteration in vaccine schedules. So
if I could stop there for
stop
the,
me.
For I want I'd encourage everyone to listen to Dr. Pierce's podcast
me
through
too.
The entirety. However, if you're ready to tune out right now, the short answer is yes, they're safe. Yes, vaccinate your child. So that's the short answer, but we'll get into more of it. But I don't want someone to tune out unaware of that there is some kind of really good evidence to say, yes, this is absolutely the right thing to do.
Okay, perfect. Okay, so, but I hope everybody else stays.
Yes, please stay. You'll hear why.
Right, and we're nice and we're funny.
True.
All right, so, before we get into the nitty gritty of it, I'm happy to say that my podcast is now international. I don't want to put any pressure on you or anything like that, but we have listeners in Japan, the UK, New Zealand, Spain, Germany, et cetera, all over the globe. So we are talking to a national audience.
International.
International audience. So
very exciting.
Hi, everybody, and konnichiwa in Japan. All right. So I was just excited about that. That's all. Dr. Mandelbaum, Bert. Well, let's begin at the beginning, and then we'll get into the controversial topics. All right. So, tell me about vaccines. How do they work? What are they?
So, the general concept of vaccination is that every person has an immune system, and that immune system is what helps them fight off infections. It's what keeps you healthy. When you're born, your immune system is not as robust as it is as you're an adult, and then it starts to wane over time. And everyone kind of intuitively knows this. You see, when you're younger, you get sick more often, and you get older, you don't get sick, and people will say, well, I've already been exposed to that, or I've had that. And all of that is mitigated by the immune system. This immune system fights the infections, and then it has an arm of it that has memory to say, in the future, should this come back, I know what to do. I know how to fight it. And that's what vaccinations counts on. So the concept of vaccination is, are there diseases that are severe enough that we don't want you to be exposed to because we worry about the consequences of having that disease so that we could, and can we prepare your immune system to fight it without actually exposing you to that. So vaccinations in general just take some portion of the viral or bacterial agent that you're trying to fight, and you expose the body to it in safe quantities where you won't get sick, but your body has now seen it. So God forbid, if in the future you're exposed to it, your body knows how to fight it and you don't suffer the consequences of the disease.
And I think that's a big point, because a lot of the diseases that these vaccines prevent are almost gone now because of the vaccine. But sometimes, I guess in medicine, sometimes we're a victim of our own success. So we've eradicated these diseases because of the vaccine. So now everybody says, well, why do I need a vaccine against something that we never see? Nobody has diphtheria anymore. So is that even a thing? You know, but it's because of the vaccine.
So you're right. And it's a great point. The formula always changes. So there's this concept of what's the risk of the disease, both how likely am I to get the disease? And if I get the disease, how likely is it that I'm going to get sick? And then what's the benefit of the vaccine? And if you could eradicate an organism from the face of the earth, aka smallpox,
right,
then now all of a sudden the benefit of vaccinating people is no longer there because the risk of the disease has disappeared. As we've tinkered with that and have been successful with lowering the incidence of these infections, the consequence of the infection stays the same because, you know, measles is measles and it causes the same effect. But as the incidence lowers, people start to wonder, like, do I need the vaccine? And we get into this period where people say, well, how important, how likely is it? And then they start to falter in immunizations. And then we get to see what's happening in 2019.
With the measles outbreak.
Right. Almost 1,000 cases so far.
Yeah. Which is, what is it, like triple or quadruple the number we've had in the last 10 years or something like that?
It's extraordinary. I'd have to look at the data. So there has not been, I think for 30 years, we have not seen numbers of measles in the United States like this.
All right. So I'm going to ask you a question you probably get from every new parent. That's politically correct. And every new parent that comes in and you say, well, this is the vaccine schedule. Are vaccines safe?
Yes.
How do you know?
So safe is a tricky word. So first, here's what you can never answer. You can never say, is something 100% safe? Because there's not a thing. You know, like we're here talking and you drove in your car. Is your car 100% safe? So nothing is 100% safe. But the safety of vaccines, we know because of data.
I came here in a Jeep, by the way, not a car.
That's much, much safer.
Thank you very much.
The safety of, sometimes the way that you need to prove something is safe is look and see what happens after you start utilizing it and how many doses. And so it's hard to give one dose of something, but vaccines, before they're licensed, have to go through trials. First, they go through pharmaceutical trials, and then they go through human trials, and then they get used in tens of thousands of people. And then when they get used over time, they get used in millions of people, and you have population data, and you say, look, there's been no changes. And this is how, and I'm sure we'll get to it, how do we know that MMR doesn't cause autism, which it does not?
We're going to get to it, but stay tuned.
Because you look at population data and you say, look at all these people who got the MMR vaccine, and does their incidence of autism change?
Now, tell me if this is true. I heard that they have to test a vaccine for 10 years before it even gets to the market. Is that correct?
So here's step one of the anti-cynicism. People are cynical about potentially pharmaceutical industry and are they not releasing data and the government. So I am in neither of those. So I am a...
Oh, I should have asked, do you have any thing to declare?
So I don't. So I am... Here's what I have to declare. Yes. I am the chair of pediatrics at Princeton Health Penn Medicine. I am a practicing pediatrician at Princeton Nassau Pediatrics for 18 years. I'm a school physician for two townships. But that's it. Like I have no research in pharma. And so the answer to that question is I'm not sure that there is a definitive line of 10 years. However, I am sure that the process is this prolonged process. Like any drug that does, you have to prove initially, you have to prove proof of concept that it'll work, and then you have to prove safety, and then you have to prove efficacy, and that takes a long, long time.
Right. All right. So I guess the next question is, what are the side effects of the vaccines? And if I'm a parent, and you know, I bring my little baby, and I want to know what to expect.
So we always, there's something called VIS sheets, vaccine information sheets. And so we, federal law says parents have to either be given them or it be made available and they could review it. But the vaccine information sheets for each vaccine lists what the side effects are. And in general, most side effects are transient. So they're short term, a day or so, and they're local. So what are the common things? Most vaccines are still through injection. So if you're going to inject something into a muscle or right under the skin, sometimes there might be some site irritation. Sometimes there's some low-grade fevers. And that's in general it. Like if a parent were to say, really, what am I looking at? That's it. Like, you know, either nothing, you'll see nothing, or maybe, you know, they'll act like their muscle's a little sore, or, you know, they'll feel a little bit of, you know, they might have a little low-grade fever. But that, in general, that's it. There are always rare side effects. Like there are rare side effects of everything. And depends on the vaccine, what those side effects could be. But though we're aware of it, the benefit of vaccinating significantly outweighs the rarity of these side effects.
Oh, great. Thank you. Now, I guess the next question, why are there so many doses? I heard the CDC recommends that, I guess, overall there's 9 vaccines, but it's 29 doses of these nine vaccines. Does that sound right to you? That's what I saw.
So, yeah, this always gets confusing to people. And some of it is, like, how our brains are wired. We see, like, how many needles is it? Like, and, you know, if we said conceptually, oh, if you take all the same stuff and you put it in one needle, that would seem so much safer than multiple needles. So the idea is you want to vaccinate people as early as possible before they're at risk for being exposed to an illness. When we're vaccinating infants in particular, because they're at risk for these illnesses, their immune system is not as robust. So in the trials, one dose of it was not effective. You had to do what they call a series of doses. So for multiple vaccines in infancy, the pneumococcal vaccine, the Haemophilus influenza type B vaccine, the rotavirus vaccine, the diphtheria tetanus pertussis vaccine, and the polio vaccine, they're a series of vaccines that we typically will do 2 months, 4 months, 6 months, and then moving on from there. Same thing with hepatitis B, which we typically do at birth. As you know, after you give us the babies, we will then immunize them within the first 24 hours. And that is a series of 3 shots. But it's meant because the immune system does better the more it sees something. So if it could see it over and over, it gets stronger and stronger and quicker to respond.
Thank you. So quick side note, I guess, because one of our areas we intersect, as you just mentioned, is the hepatitis B for the newborns.
Right.
So I guess a lot of my patients, who are parents-to-be, are asking me, well, why does the baby need it that soon? It was just born. It's not going to be exposed to hepatitis B right after birth.
What do you tell them?
I tell them that...
Ask your pediatrician.
I said... That's exactly. And also, my sister-in-law works for the Hepatitis B Foundation, and this is her field of expertise. So this is what I tell them. From what my knowledge is, some kids are lost to follow-up after delivery, and hepatitis B, believe it or not, worldwide is huge, as I learned through Dr. Shari Cohen. And basically, you have them there. Let's start the vaccination process right away. And also, you know, you could transmit hepatitis B just from the delivery, from mom to baby. So that's what I tell them.
And I think that that's mostly right. So I'll add more to your...
So it's like a B plus.
Yes. Okay. I'm going to get you to an A.
Okay, thank you.
So every one of these discussions almost always encompasses all of the interesting things about vaccination. So the first thing we said is, when is a kid at risk? So is a newborn, hepatitis B can be transmitted through blood products, through sexual activity, through IV drug use. So the typical response will be like, how is my newborn at risk? So the first way they're at risk is through vertical transmission, so from the mom to the baby. So
I get credit for that one.
You get total credit for that one. So the issues are, what if the mom is negative? So the parents will say, well, I was negative in pregnancy. What if the testing, there's false negative testing, there's moms who slip through the cracks, you can be exposed to hepatitis B after you do the testing. So what if you contracted hep B, you were negative when you were tested halfway through, and now you contracted hepatitis B. So that is step one, the reason we're doing it in the first 24 hours, and because if we immunize them in that first 24 hours, and they were incidentally exposed from mom didn't know, slipped through the cracks.
Things happen.
We can cut down on the transmission of hepatitis B to the baby just by immunizing them in that first 24 hours. The second issue is it's not just IV drug use and sexual transmission. You can get it through either through other blood exposures, and I know your kids are just a bit older, though home now from college, but younger kids have the tendency to do things like bite.
Really?
Yes. Yeah. So, there are a lot of children who do have chronic hepatitis B. So we have kids in our practice who have chronic hepatitis B. So they are carriers. They were exposed vertically,
right,
mom to baby, and they have hepatitis B. And these kids are not, they're healthy kids. They don't have any symptoms, but they're able to transmit it to other people, and they're not excluded from school. You would not know who they are, and we wouldn't want to exclude them, but they are not overtly symptomatic with hepatitis B, but they could spread it. And before the hepatitis B vaccine came on board, any idea how many kids per year got hepatitis B under the age of 10?
I'm not going to guess. I take the fifth.
Yeah. So under about 20,000, I think it was 18,000. Wow. So it's a real thing.
So I just want to interject that we are in the central New Jersey area. We are in a suburban area. So you're having, it's not unusual for you to have a young patient with hepatitis B. It was a carrier in this, suburban New Jersey town.
Correct. And we have a big practice. We have, they're mostly healthy kids. Is it common? No. Do we have multiple patients with it? Yes.
So I guess, to me, I think that's one of the things that's the big issue, is that maybe parents aren't seeing that these diseases are real. I mean, it seems like it's just, oh, these are what your textbook tells you. But I don't know anybody who would have hepatitis B, but apparently they probably do.
For sure.
So I guess I wanted to drive that part home.
Yeah, and I'll... So much of this is perception of these diseases are not significant, perception that the diseases are uncommon. And as those perceptions change, people's feelings about them radically change. I'll tell you a quick anecdote.
So, please do.
Thank you. So we're here, as Dr. Pierce said, in central New Jersey. And I think it was in 2008 that New Jersey decided to mandate flu vaccine for kids under the age of 5 who are in daycare or preschool, which I'm supportive of. However, not all parents were supportive of it. And it was the typical argument, should we vaccinate, how should the state or the federal government mandate that I have to get my vaccine? It should be my choice. Anyway, the state did. And a lot of parents were aghast. I'm not going to do it. And the law in New Jersey says, if you don't get, and the law is still in place, if you don't get your flu vaccine by December 31st of that year, you have to be disenrolled from daycare or preschool until, I think, March 31st.
I think this is also probably one of the underlying issues, is autonomy or my freedom to choose versus public safety.
So totally. But I think you're absolutely right. But just to finish that perception story, so many of these parents were aggravated. How can you make my kid, this is 2008, how can you make my kid get the flu shot? 2009, H1N1 occurs.
Uh-huh.
and there's all this media press about the H1N1 is a variant of the influenza. So there's this flu spreading around. The media is picking up on it. H1N1 hasn't been around for however many years, and it's going to be disastrous. And people are dying. Again, about 100 to 150 kids a year in the United States die from the flu or complications of the flu. But there was this concern, and that with the vaccine, the current vaccine was not prepared for H1N1. So they formulated an H1N1 vaccine, and they were getting it out to the offices. Within a year, the same parents who were saying, how dare you make me get my kid the flu vaccine, when there was a shortage, those parents were coming and saying,
begging,
you better, I will sue you if you don't have, you are limiting my kid from getting this vaccine that they need. And nothing changed. It's the same flu vaccine, you know, but their perception of the risk changed.
It became real.
Correct.
It became real.
And that's what happens.
Right. So, Bert. Dr. Mandelbaum, what about the ingredients in the vaccines? People are concerned because there's aluminum in there, there's formaldehyde in there, there's other things in there that people are concerned that are maybe, this is, can't be good for my baby to have this in their system. What do you say to that?
So first, everything has been tested. It's been shown to be safe. There's lots of data if you want to do reading on this. The CDC has information on it. Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, which is a partner of Princeton Penn Medicine, has a really robust website. They have a vaccine education center, and they have a bunch of information about it. So props to CHOP for having that, and feel free to check it out there so you can get more information on your own. The idea, though, is that in order to make these vaccines, you have to do a couple of things. One is you have to make sure, as you're putting stuff in a bottle and you're sending out to people, that it doesn't get infected. So some of these things are to promote and protect the sterility of the vaccine. So you have to make sure, it would stink if you were taking a vaccine and it was, you know, full of, it got contaminated and there was, you were now putting people at risk of getting an infection because the vaccine liquid itself was no longer sterile.
Which is really what people are afraid of. They're afraid that this stuff in vaccines is going to cause a problem, but it sounds like the stuff they're putting in is to prevent the contamination, not to cause contamination.
Correct. So that's step there. There's two things they do. They put one in there to protect it from getting contaminated. And the second thing they do is something called adjuvants. So adjuvant is a term that is meant to make the vaccine more effective. This way you want to stimulate the immune response so that when you give this vaccine, the immune response sees it and is robust and gives you lifelong protection. So there's a few things that they will use as adjuvants, and those are the two things that end up in a vaccine in addition to the actual vaccine itself.
Great, thanks. All right, so here's the topic that's what we call the elephant in the room, one that everybody wants to know. Do vaccines cause autism?
No. Queen
Bobon. Can you yes. No, I'm sorry, Dr. Mandelbaum. I'm gonna hold you to this because the people out there want to know, how do you know it doesn't cause autism?
So I said earlier in the podcast, first, there's no plausible hypothesis. Like, there's nothing that makes sense about causing it. The second issue is you look at these population studies. So you look at a group of people who got the MMR vaccine, a group of people who didn't, and you say, is the incidence of autism changed? And if it hasn't, then you say, well, sure, it doesn't seem to make sense that it's increasing the risk of it. And then you can flip around and say, then why are people saying it? So, and this is, it's important to understand, because you hear these passionate stories from families who say, I have a family member or I have a friend who knows someone and this is what happened to them. And so autism is a social language disorder. And these are children who are born, who look healthy and are happy. And in the first year of life, it's almost impossible to detect autism. So we know that there is a genetic basis for autism. without getting into autism itself, there's probably multiple different genes and multiple different paths, because we call autism an autism spectrum disorder, and these kids look all different. So we know it's not just one disease or one gene issue. But as we know, it runs in families. So if you're a boy who is diagnosed with autism and you have a sibling who has autism, you have a sibling who's born, they have a much higher risk of having autism. A boy having a sibling has a 25% risk of having autism. Now, in those scenarios, we can have developmental pediatricians have looked at kids. So you have a child who has autism, there's a boy who's born, they now know it's a 1 in 4 risk. So they can watch that baby over their first year of life and say, can they detect it? In the first 6 months, it's almost impossible to detect. In the second half of the year, under a microscope, maybe you're seeing some signs, but you really start to see signs when language is developing, which is around 15 to 18 months. And guess what?
That's when you get the MMR vaccine.
Oh, yeah. And so you end up with this correlation in time, which as humans, we're meant to say, if this happens, then this bad thing happened, there must be a cause. What happened right before it? Everything else seemed fine.
Right.
And that's where the initial kind of correlations have come from.
Great.
As we're sitting here, I just pulled up the computer and we looked at Autism Speaks. So like is a national foundation is obviously looking to help answer the cure of autism. And even from their website, they say, what causes autism? So good job, Autism Speaks, on putting this out there. No effect on risk, vaccines. Each family has a unique experience with an autism diagnosis, and for some it corresponds with the timing of their child's vaccines. At the same time, scientists have conducted extensive research over the last 2 decades to determine whether there is any link between childhood vaccinations and autism. The results of the research is clear. Vaccines do not cause autism.
Which is on autismspeaks.com, right? Yeah.
.org.
.org, sorry. And for those who don't know that, they're probably the most, I guess, proponents of cure for autism and research for autism.
Right. And they're probably the biggest national foundation,
right,
promoting a cure and looking for an etiology of autism.
I'm going to tell you this. If people listen to my earlier broadcast, they know I'm an OBGYN. So obviously this is your expertise, but, you know, being a physician, knowing that we were going to have this discussion, I actually did, you know, research.
Good for you.
And I actually came upon it as if I don't know anything. I'm a parent. I'm just doing my own research online, which is what your parents are telling you.
Right.
However, I do have a special expertise in the field of medicine, science, et cetera, especially the training, et cetera. So I did my own research. So what we learned in med school is that there's levels of evidence that experiments can produce. And the better the experiment, the more accurate the results. So the better level of evidence, the more truthful your experiment or your study is. So I guess a lot of people say, well, there's conflicting studies, there's conflicting data. But is it conflicting if one has evidence of A+, super thumbs up, and then there's one has evidence of this is barely scraping as calling it evidence? So that's what I was looking at. I said, okay, what's the conflicting evidence? So you know, and I know, but the people out there may not know, like the best study that could be published is something called a Cochrane database review. And this is basically a best of. So they look at everything that's published and they grade it in terms of how good the study was done, how strong the evidence is, et cetera, et cetera. So I think in 2012, there was this Cochrane review. And we know, but this Cochrane review, this is for us who are in science and medicine, this is definitive. This is like you could take this to the bank. It's not supported by any companies or anything like that. This is a review, and the amount of patients they review is in the millions. And so basically in 2012, the Cochrane review basically showed no evidence of vaccines, not just at autism, but of diabetes, of all these other things. I guess that that supposedly through lesser evidence was linked to vaccines. So to me as a person, I'm an educated person who's a physician. Now I'm looking up, I see a Cochrane database that shows no link to autism from vaccines. And then on the flip side, a lot of it's what we call the anecdotal data. And for those of you who don't know, anecdotal means, like you said before, my sister, my brother, my friend, a friend of a friend had this happen to them. So therefore, this is the cause. So that is the weakest on the spectrum, where a Cochrane review is the best and anecdotal is the worst. The other side that's telling you that there's conflicting reports, that's it's mostly anecdotal data or data that's published that the level of evidence is almost as close to anecdotal as you can get. So it's almost like, you know, the New York Yankees are playing your local Little League team and saying, well, this could go either way.
So you're absolutely right. You know, thankfully, most people get their vaccines. So that's great. The out of the people who don't get their vaccines, most of them are vaccine hesitant. They're just worried. Right. And there's this kind of human nature aspect where you have to assess all this data. And, you know, there's always a little bit of distrust. And unfortunately, in 2019, it seems like there's a lot of distrust in government and in science and, you know, the pharmaceutical
industry. I share that, by the way. I'm a conspiracy theorist, FYI.
Well, and you know, they haven't done the best job in reassuring us that they're always looking out for our best interests. But just in terms of vaccines, so for a vaccine to be not only FDA licensed, never mind that, but approved and recommended, it has to go through the CDC, through two different bodies. There's a smaller subcommittee and then the regular subcommittee, and then the American Academy of Pediatrics. So you have to have all of these science and pediatricians who rotate through, who are looking at the evidence and looking what is in the best interest of patients. And you have to say either you have evidence that they don't, which is really far-fetched to think that you could find something in your Google searching that was not available to them as they made the recommendations, or you have to say in your cynicism they're all bought off, which is also, you know, I get you can follow the money, but in things like where the scientists and so many people and have to look at it and make these decisions, that's also far-fetched.
I'll share this with you personally. I have my, as I mentioned before, I have my own suspicions. I don't like big pharma. You know, I do see that they have caused damage through marketing of things and almost kind of influencing the physicians through marketing rather than through science. So I'm very suspicious, everybody out there. But I'm going to tell you, these are major medical organizations that say vaccines are safe. The CDC, which you know, it may have some argument. But how about the IOM, which is the Institute of Medicine? And these guys are really tough on physicians. I mean, they put out a report in 1999 that 100,000 people die a year from medical mistakes and errors that are preventable. I mean, these guys are tough on the establishment. They are not bought off by any company. And when they say something, they mean it. And they say vaccines are safe. And I'll give you one more that I found very influential is the World Health Organization, the WHO. So this is not United States. This is not anything going on here that's a conspiracy. This is World Health, and they're also extremely tough on the practice of medicine. They've told us OBGYNs that if our C-section rates are higher than 15%, we're doing excessive and extraneous C-sections for no reason. I mean, these guys are tough and they're no holds barred. And if they see something that's wrong, they tell it to you. And they're global. It's not just the United States. And they say vaccines are safe. So to me, you know, if you look at the experts in the field, the level of evidence, you know, you really can't even make an argument for the other side.
So I didn't tell you this beforehand. So I don't think I mentioned it when you had asked me to be on the podcast. But last week, I was part of a think tank, so to speak, called Extending the Cure, that was run through Princeton University and had brought in national experts across the country to talk about overuse of antibiotics and underuse of vaccines, and are they the same people who's doing it, and who are doing it, and how do we make it better? And so we had a lot of these conversations about these vaccine hesitant people, and how do you? We get it. Like, you're absolutely, you nailed all the data, but let me give you a quick anecdote, and if you just. You tell me your
emotional... It's very low-level evidence,
which, but totally fair, but I want your emotional response.
Okay. I'm emotional, so it's good.
So imagine a four-month-old baby mm-hmm. who is coming in for their checkup. They're healthy and they're doing great. Now they go in, like in our practice, we have a separate immunization room where they go in, the nurses do the immunizations. They're sitting in their mother's lap. They're about to get the vaccine. The nurse draws up the first vaccine. She's holding it in her hand, and the baby has a seizure. Now, there's a lot of syndromes. There's a syndrome called Dravet syndrome, where babies have seizures in the first 4 to 6 months of life. They're getting sick, they have it. And there's general epilepsy syndromes that at some point kids start to have a seizure. So one point you didn't, and one. Now the child's in the mother's lap.
Before the vaccine's given.
Before the vaccine.
Okay.
And they have a seizure. Intuitively, did that vaccine cause that?
Of course not.
Okay. For a second, forget that story. Play it back, same thing. But that vaccine was given 30 seconds later. The child, I mean, 30 seconds earlier. The child has the vaccine and now has the seizure. Take that story and imagine that you are a friend of that parent, or you're talking to that parent, and you tell them all this data that it's safe. It is so hard. It is that we have this emotional kind of, this evolutionary pull, I think, to look at temporal associations. My kid got this and it was invasive. You stuck them with something and then 10 seconds later they had a seizure. You cannot tell me that it's not possible. Now it's not. The kid had, you know, the kid was going to have the seizure, but it is really hard.
Parents not hearing that.
As we're taking this data, and it is hard to get that information out to people. So they look for these heuristics of how do I assess it's safe? I'm hearing all these things. The other thing that we've gotten much better at this, but in the mid-2000s, when there was this first controversy of does MMR cause autism, which again we've said,
I think we made a good argument.
I hope so. But what we would do is you would take a proponent, a parent who said my child was fine. The story that I just mentioned of, you know, instead of vaccine and a seizure, it was vaccine and then autism, and you would put them side by side. So like Larry King Live would have like Jenny McCarthy on one side and the director of the CDC on the other, and there is this perception of equal weight, right? Hold on, let's see. CDC, what do you say? Well, the evidence says this is all fine. Jenny McCarthy, what do you say? My child was fine until you gave them all these vaccines, and look how many there are. And a parent who's watching is saying, I don't know. This makes sense. What, you know? And so it's hard. We did a disservice to ourselves, to each other, as we're trying to educate people by allowing platforms of people with anecdotal data to compare that to actual evidence-based data.
And I think that's the bottom line. And honestly, I think my goal of this discussion was not to convince, I guess what we call now the anti-vaxxers, who are people who are passionate or sure. We know when, as you said, when emotion gets involved, there's nothing that's going to change your mind. So, but I think we are, want to reassure the people who are getting vaccinated, which is the majority of people, which is great. But the people who are vaccine hesitant, I think, I just wanted to go line by line what they're reading and just giving it a perspective, giving it a, you know, a weight, how to, because almost now, like, you're, I guess it's, I feel bad, these parents who used to just go to the pediatrician and say, you know what's best, take care of the baby.
Right.
Now they're like, oh, now I have to make these decisions. I didn't think I had to make these decisions, and now I do.
So I talked about this extending the cure meeting that we had, and you're right, it's hard. Like, informed consent, like, how can you really inform someone? They're looking to you for guidance on what the right thing to do is, and everyone, you can't consume all this literature and assess it and have the tools to make the right decision. So at some point, you have to put your faith in somebody and say, I trust you. One of the ways, so I have two kids. They're Josh and Sophie. They're smart.
How old
wonderful.
Are they?
Josh is 13 going on 14, and Sophie just turned 12. But if I want to cut to the chase, what do you think a parent asks me?
Did you vaccinate your children?
And I say, of course.
And I did mine as well.
Right. But that gets to the heart of a lot of times how parents want to make decisions. What did you know, tell me what you really think. And a lot of times they could say, well, what you did for your kid is, you know, is clearly what you think is in the best interest.
I was actually going on Facebook the other day, and there was a similar conversation that this guy Z Dog, I don't know if you know Z Dog,
sure.
And he had this
shout out to Z Dog.
Z loves Z Dog. Maybe he'll listen. and then he had a pediatrician on who's Dr. Blair Duddy. I don't know, but he was very personable.
Not as
handsome as you.
Thank you.
I'm going to say that.
Luckily, is a podcast.
Right. Look. But that's why I do it. So for myself, that is. He gave a line that I thought was really appropriate and funny, but appropriate at the same time. And he says, hey, look, I'm an idiot in many other areas of life, but in this area, I'm an expert.
Right. Yeah.
So, and I really related to that because, you know, when I'm at home and I put a shelf up, it always leans. It's never straight. And my wife looks at me like, you're an idiot.
Right. And,
but in the field of medicine and what I do, and we're kind of experts.
Yeah, for sure.
This is what we do. This is how we live.
Yeah, and right. We talk about this every day. We have the best interests of the patients we take care of at heart, and we try to give them the best judgment we can. And the vaccines are not only are safe but effective. And these diseases are bad. So, like, the luckily, so I've been in practice 18 years or so. So a lot of the diseases, so we see much less chickenpox than we used to see before.
Right.
The pneumococcal vaccine has been super effective about preventing significant diseases. Like, we still see ear infections because of it, but we see a lot less pneumonias or, God forbid, meningitis because of it. Haemophilus influenza type B, the people older than I would say that in their training, they would have these terrible cases of epiglottitis and of the kids, you know, of where kids would die. Kids would be in the ICU, and we don't see it anymore because of the effectiveness of these vaccines.
And which is perfect, because this kind of rounds up our topic. What I mentioned in the beginning is that in the past, people don't realize what it was like before vaccines, because kids died.
Yeah,
people
for sure.
People died by the thousands and by the millions. I mean, also anecdotal for me, like, me and my wife like watching a lot of these like Henry VIII shows on Netflix, etc., like a lot of British royalty shows. And like back in the day, I think the saying was you have to have a lot of kids, because you have to have at least two boys, because if you wanted to pass down the royalty line,
right.
And we have UK listeners, so they know what I'm talking about. And I think the saying was, you have to have one heir and then one spare, because the chance of your child making it to adulthood back then was a crapshoot. It was you know, you flip a coin.
Right.
All right, Dr. Mandelbaum, I think, Bert, we'll go out to dinner later on. And I think, unless you had something you wanted to say that you were like dying to say and didn't get a chance.
No, I thank everyone for listening and thinking this through. And please believe me, we're doing everything we can to protect the health and wellness of the youth that we take care of.
Despite our profits from treating the sick. thanks everybody out there in the world. Sayonara, Japan. And look forward to our next episode.
Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.